This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 84. Today we speak with Martin Downs about handling truth and error in the church. Christ the Center is listener-supported. We want to thank all those who've contributed to help us make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/support. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and we have a great panel today. I have with me Jim Cassidy, who's pastor of Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. It's great to have you back, Jim. Glad to have you.
Good to be here, Camden.
Yeah, we also have Jeff Waddington, who's teacher of the congregation there at Calvary OPC. It's great to have you on with us too, Jeff.
Oh, it's great to be here too.
And we also have our regular, Nick Batzig, who's a church planter in Richmond Hill, Georgia, for the PCA, working out of Independent Presbyterian Church now. It's great to have you on as well, Nick.
Thanks, Camden. It's good to be on.
Nick, of course, has lost his voice preaching with fire and vigor or something like that. But he's
brimstone burnt his throat.
Yeah, but he's a trooper today, and we're glad to have him on. And so we're excited to speak with our special guest, Martin Downs, who is the pastor of Christ Church in Deeside. He's also the webmaster and the author of the popular blog Against Heresies at against-heresies.blogspot.com. It's great to have you on, Martin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited because today we're going to be speaking about this new book, Risking the Truth, Interviews on Handling Truth and Error in the Church. And Martin Downs has written it, put it together, and has some helpful articles and introduction and some discussion about what heresies are, how they come up, how they get into the church, why they persist. But this is really an interesting book, Martin. It's formatted in a way that I really think is quite novel and helpful. But what you've done, and to let the listeners know, is you've interviewed several leading theologians, as Sinclair Ferguson uses the modern phrase, thought leaders, and I think that's appropriate. But he interviews several people on the issue of handling truth and error in the church. And it's really, really fascinating just to see the different perspectives from all these solid theologians on this very issue. Martin, what gave you this idea, and how did this spring up, this particular format for this book?
Well, January 2007, during the vacation, I just thought to myself, if I could put together a series of questions that I could ask some of the leading professors, senior ministers in the UK, United States, and you know, wherever I could get an interview. Just some of the questions about how do you deal with church members who are attracted to false teaching? What are some of the big issues facing us today? How can we deal with them? How do you strike a balance in your ministry between prosecuting error and teaching God's people? And so really, I just started compiling a list of questions and thought about some of the men I wanted to put those questions to. And my initial goal was just to put them on my blog, and hopefully they would stimulate thought and encourage others. And that's how it began, until one of the contributors said to me, look, you really should put these in permanent form. Some of the answers are really helpful. And then the whole project became a book. So, yeah, that's how it came about.
Well, that's interesting, and this is a really important subject, and it's challenging sometimes. I've had several conversations with friends at the seminary, and just being involved in the church, it's difficult to know how to go about handling error, knowing when it's serious enough of an issue to, to prosecute, when you should do that, when you should teach and shepherd. Handling that balance is very difficult. But could you explain just a little bit about what the actual nature of heresy is? How would you actually define it, and how would you distinguish it from just ignorance or error?
Yeah, sure. There's a quotation at the start of the book. I don't think I even attributed it properly, but it comes from Michael Horton. A definition that I find helpful. He said that heresy is any teaching that directly contradicts the clear and direct witness of the scriptures on a point of salvific importance. So we're talking about those kind of errors that deny the person of Christ, his two natures, the doctrine of the Trinity. We're talking about doctrines of such significant importance that if we redefine them, we really no longer have the Christian faith. And I suppose if you're looking biblically for the roots of that, your mind goes to texts like 1 Corinthians 15 and Paul setting out the gospel of Christ dying for our sins and rising from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures. One thinks of Galatians 1 and Paul's anathema, not only against the false teachers infiltrating the Galatian churches, but also even if he himself as an apostle had taught a different gospel, because there is, by definition, there can only be one gospel, then they should be accursed. Of course, that's quite different, isn't it, from asking a church member to adequately explain the Trinity. And sometimes people do, either in their prayers or in their explanations, they don't get things quite right. And the big difference is, even if folks sincerely at times misunderstand or don't adequately state things, whether they are fundamentally opposed to a right and orthodox statement of the truth. That seems to me is one of the key differences. It was Calvin who said that ambition is the mother of all heresy. And it's not just, heresy is not just not adequately explaining a truth, but actually being fundamentally unwilling to submit to the truth and to prefer a different definition of the doctrine of God and the person of Christ and the gospel.
That's very helpful. That's very helpful, actually.
As you researched out this question and had spoken to these theologians and pastors, perhaps you could tell us, was there a common thread or a common agreement as to what today's greatest, most pernicious form of heresy in the church that they're struggling with and fighting against?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to say that a big influence on my thinking 11 and a half years ago was reading Fitzsimons Allison's book, The Cruelty of Heresy. And as well as wanting to distinguish between ideas that are errors that are so bad that they are soul-destroying and would revise our whole understanding of the Christian faith, there are other errors that are damaging, and yet we would not want to pronounce those who hold them as being accursed, as preaching a false gospel. One thinks of, I guess, John Wesley's view of sanctification. I think that's the view of perfect love and that sanctification comes by a crisis. I think that would be desperately harmful for anybody who took that up and genuinely believed it. And yet, we're not going to want to shove Wesley into the category of being a heretic for that reason. So whilst all errors are harmful, some of them are so harmful that we really do have a different faith and no gospel at all. And I think that's reflected in the interviews as well, that it wasn't just views that are, you could clearly label as heresies that I wanted to deal with, but other views as well that are particularly damaging today. Having said that, some of the big issues, I mean, they're fairly obvious ones. In recent years, within, I guess, that broad evangelical tent, a desire to recast justification by faith alone, penal substitution. I mean, the authority of Scripture has been an ongoing issue for at least over a century. The doctrine of hell, the plausibility of an annihilationist view of eternal punishment, all those are areas in the book that I specifically wanted to home in on, and so there are specific interviews. I think Tom Schreiner on penal substitution, Robert Peterson I interviewed on hell. Ligon Duncan asked him questions about the new perspective and the federal vision, and Greg Beale, who's going to be going to Westminster, isn't he? Or is he already adjunct professor? ask him specifically questions about inerrancy and the authority of Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Martin, I thought it was interesting, Derek Thomas's response to your question. I think it's on page 67, to negativity in Martin Lloyd-Jones' statement about good men often become overly critical and negative. And Derek Thomas had basically answered that by saying that in a culture that is so against biblical truth and absolute standards, almost anything that you say will be perceived as negative. What advice would you have to some who really care about doctrinal standards, but who don't want to be perceived as overly negative?
That's a good question. So on the one hand, if you take a clear line on any theological issue and say this is right, and by definition other views are wrong, you're bound to be perceived as being negative, and you can't control to a certain degree the way your theological opponents then will cast you as being negative. And you realize at some point we're not just dealing with theological differences, but a certain amount of of rhetoric and people marking their territory. I suppose one of the great dangers is where in your own soul you become preoccupied with error, and the thing that thrills you is no longer Christ and the gospel and the wonder of that sinners are justified by faith alone because Christ's righteousness is imputed to us. It's when you discern in your own soul that the thing that thrills you is no longer the grace of God in the gospel, but the thrill of the chase and the thrill of prosecuting error, the thrill of being proved right. So I do think that there has to be, we can't help control what critics say about us. But what we do have to guard is our own heart so that we are content with the grace of God. And I just, for my own reading, I'm reading John Owen on this, enormously helpful. When he was commissioned to write, that 400-page critique of Socinianism, and in his preface he surveys the history of Socinianism and the reason why it arose. But he ends by saying, look, what good is it if I can perceive the errors of others, and yet I don't enjoy communion with God in my own soul. If I understand the doctrine of the person of Christ and his deity, and yet these things no longer thrill me. So I do think that's the key thing, is in our own souls, are we enjoying the grace of God? Is that leading us to humility rather than preoccupation with other people's theological faults?
That's really helpful, and we often find that unfortunately people sometimes, because of that thrill of the chase, as you mentioned, drum up heresies and almost try to always find the next big enemy. And not to say that we shouldn't always seek out error and try to address it, but sometimes things get made a bigger deal than they need to be, or get treated or exaggerated more than they ought. Yep. And need to be maybe handled in a fashion more akin to the early stages of church discipline that you find in Matthew, rather than the later stages. We like to jump to the end in order to have that exaggerated finish or that definitive answer to some error. And there's always sometimes some sinful inclination of self-pride and self-exaltation that accompanies that. We need to always be aware of.
Yeah. And it's true to say that some people are quite restless, aren't they? You see them and they're obsessed with a particular issue, and then within 18 months they've moved on to something else. And I remember a really astute comment by Phil Johnson of Grace to You and Pyromaniac fame, is that some people never get to know their own theological heritage well enough that they're always on the surface and they never sink their roots down deep enough, and they're forever then moving from one thing to another. And I found that incredibly helpful, and thinking just in terms of the you know, the Reformed tradition and the whole exegetical foundation for our understanding of the covenants and the doctrines of grace, and the vast literature that exists, and some people really need to get their roots down and to understand the solid basis for all this truth.
Mm-hmm. Martin, could you talk a little bit about what you discovered from your interviews in terms of perhaps who is to, maybe this is a wrong way to put it, but who is to blame for current embracing of heresies that are out there? In other words, the church, the seminaries, both. I don't know, what have you turned up? I'm just thinking a little bit of your interview with Carl Truman, where this issue and this question comes up, and he speaks about seminary students, the life of a seminary student. He talks about how talks about the life of a minister, and talks about being grounded theologically in your seminary training. I don't know if you found anything where perhaps there's a common thread in terms of at whose feet do we lay this blame of heresy creeping into the church today?
That's such a great question. There are things going on in the lives of individuals and local settings, which often can be quite self-contained. And then there are other moves that gain a much wider hearing. And if a church and a seminary has a clear confessional position, and it's the responsibility of men, with all the great statements that we might have written down, it's our fidelity to those statements and our willingness both to positively teach them and also to uphold them when they are being stretched to breaking point or deliberately contradicted. That at that point, however great our confessional orthodoxy is, there has to be a heart commitment to really stand for the truth, and sometimes to do that at a cost. And so to that extent, the blame usually falls upon the weakness of teaching and ruling elders. That's not to downplay at times also the subtlety of error and the fact that you can be thrown by people that you've respected, whose ministries that you've benefited from, and yet when they change theologically and change for the worse, you can find that hard, I think, to cope with. So there's that on a local level. I do think certain institutions, either seminaries or you think of the world of evangelical publishing, can give certain ideas plausibility. And so because you trust the publishing house or the institution or the particular publication, your defenses go down. I suppose in particular, I think of the openness of God in the mid-1990s and the credibility given to it by Christianity today. I can think of other situations in the United Kingdom over similar matters. And you can just give an issue plausibility. So if you effectively say this is within the boundaries of evangelical orthodoxy, and so it becomes an in-house debate when historically it's never been an in-house debate, and it's been a very clear issue of orthodoxy and heresy. You know, to the undiscerning individual, they're going to be more receptive to those ideas because a culture has been created of plausibility. And again, that's a failure to uphold clear standards of truth.
I've got a question from Nick I'm going to relay to you, Martin.
Oh, that was quick.
It's a great one, though. Now, Guy Waters emphasized the need to recognize that each of us, as individuals, of course, are liable to error ourselves. And we've often thought if it could happen to Peter, like it did in Galatians, then it, of course, could happen to us. And Peter was an apostle. So do you find it to be a necessary key to staying on course in regard to gospel soundness, that we always examine ourselves? And what can we actually do as we are trying to address error in the church? What can we actually do to protect ourselves from falling into error, and how do we just handle that issue?
Yeah, I'd really help our comment in one of John Owen's volumes, where he says, unless the Lord continually lays an awe upon the hearts of men that keeps them content with the simplicity and mystery of the gospel, if that doesn't happen, then error comes in like a flood. So I do have to ask myself, am I content with the content and the limits of biblical revelation? Am I fundamentally submissive to the Word of God and to the teaching of the Word? And am I content to draw the boundaries where Scripture draws the boundaries and not transgress those boundaries? And effectively trying to rationalize beyond what God has said. So I do have to ask myself if I'm content with those things, or whether my pride actually wants to stray beyond them for whatever reason, if I want a coherence that is greater than I think Scripture is really giving me. So I do think that really is a fundamental matter about the disposition of my thought and my affections toward God. And the danger of wanting to make a name for oneself, wanting to strike out with such originality that effectively you're going after innovations and novelty. Those are some, I think, at least the beginning areas that I have to keep a safeguard on. There's all sorts of reasons we end up in error. Sometimes we're too lazy. Sometimes we're just downright too ignorant, and we have to ask ourselves whether we are teachable. I do think in the book of Acts of Apollos, when Priscilla and Aquila hear Apollos preach, and they see fine gifts and a clear understanding on some matters, but he doesn't fully grasp the whole message. And they don't berate him for it, but they instruct him. And it's quite clear that Apollos has the humility to accept their help and instruction. And so I have to ask myself whether, A, am I fundamentally submissive to apostolic teaching, and am I willing to be corrected when I've got things wrong? The danger signs is when I refuse to be corrected.
Yeah. Hey, Martin, do you have any advice for our listeners, particularly those within the pastoral ministry? It seems as if, and I don't know the way things are on that side of the pond, but at least here in America, we have expectations of our pastors that they be very busy, here, there, everywhere. Very little time is left for the pastor in his study to read. Could you perhaps talk a little bit about the relationship between fending off error and reading good books during your study time as a pastor?
Yeah, John, one of the things I've been really grateful for with the church where I serve as a pastor is that I was appointed, and the congregation had a clear, on the whole, a clear understanding of my role. So I wasn't being asked to do things that really others would be able to do. And it's great to have church members say to you, look, I actually don't expect you to visit me. I expect you to be in your study, and I expect you to be using your hours to study hard. And a recognition that that is the necessary work in order to really adequately serve the congregation, giving yourself to the ministry of the word and prayer. And actually, that's the wrong order. The apostolic order is prayer and the ministry of the word. And it could be that if you find yourself too busy, you have to put the brakes on and think, well, do I need to lovingly re-educate the congregation so that actually I can give myself to the things for the long term that are most for their help and benefit. But it's difficult, isn't it? There's always some jobs where you are. You know where you are at the end of the day. You know where you are at the end of the week. You know what goals you've achieved. Ministry is much more fluid in the sense of, well, I know where I am in terms of sermon preparation. But there's always more to do than I can possibly do. It's a difficult issue. I wrestle with it all the time, and I'm not sure I've got all the answers yet.
Follow-up question on that, Martin. What books, I know this may be putting you on the spot here, maybe you didn't give this thought ahead of time, but what books, and you've mentioned Owen several times, but particularly what books would you recommend to pastors listening to the show? Perhaps they did not receive a wonderful Orthodox theological education in seminary. What kind of books, I'm not saying that's me, by the way, but what books would you recommend for pastors to be reading to stay on target and to ground themselves even deeper with deeper roots so as not to fall into heresy or to be aware of heresy and to defend against it?
I think you have to take the most central doctrines that we hold to. And you have to read not just the most recent books, not even books written in the last 100 years, but be willing to invest money and time in reading works that take you back even further. One of the things that has really struck me in the last few years is how a better acquaintance with historical theology, not just church history, but reading the works of great preachers and theologians in the past, you just realize that so many of the debates in the last 20, 30, 40 years are a rehash of conflicts that have gone on before. So I was struck the other day, I was rereading Robert Brough's essay, The Evangelical Megashift, Move Away from Judicial Categories and Thinking About God, Categories of Law, Guilt, Condemnation, and a move towards, this is 1990 when he was writing, a move towards more family and fatherly and touchy-feely images among evangelicals. And yet, at the same time I was rereading that essay and reading through George Smeaton's work on Christ's Doctrine of the Atonement, first published in 1870, 1871, and Smeaton's talking about the same issues and the same drift in his own day. So without wanting to overprescribe in terms of naming specific books, I think, for example, if you did take, I'm contradicting myself now, if you do take The Atonement, I mean, every pastor must read John Stott's work, The Cross of Christ. But then I think if you have to read books like Smeaton's two volumes, The Banner of Truth that produced Christ's Doctrine of the Atonement and The Apostles' Doctrine of the Atonement, I think Hugh Martin's work on the Atonement is being republished this summer. Those kind of volumes. To give you another feel, in terms of the openness of God and God's foreknowledge and exhaustive omniscience, I do think John Frame's book, No Other God, is an excellent read and an excellent critique. Bruce Ware's book, I think God's Lesser Glory, books like those are helpful. And yet if you go back further and read Stephen Charnock and his discourses on the attributes of God, when he deals with God's foreknowledge, you find he's exegeting the same texts, he's dealing with the same issues, he's dealing with the same denials of God's foreknowledge. The general advice would be to dig deeper and deeper. And man, I tell you what, every time I read John Owen, I just think, why am I reading other stuff?
That's true.
Because he just deals with, if you invest the time in him, his handling of scripture, his understanding of, and of course his Welshness, the man was just on everything.
Of course the Welshness. Now, speaking more specifically about the format of this book and the various contributors, I'm assuming many of them are bringing up similar themes and things that we've already been talking about. But what did you find? Did you find anything interesting in terms of the differences between the responses of the various contributors?
Perhaps if I could just say something about why I went for interviews rather than
please
other format for the book. I just think you get a blend of biblical reflection, historical awareness, as Carl Truman and Scott Clark, and given that kind of church history dimension, you get all of that. But there's a personal element in terms of our own handling of the issues and asking authors to reflect particularly on that. And so the whole thing is pastorally driven rather than it being, I don't mean pejoratively, but just a merely an academic scribing various different kinds of false teaching. So that was really critical to what I wanted the book to be about and what I wanted the book to achieve. Okay, so I've got that in. So if you can answer it.
Did you find any specific differences between them all in terms of how they responded or any particular emphases, anything that struck you or surprised you as you brought these interviews together?
Yeah, there are no glaring differences, but I think different men just put the weight of their answers in.
Just different perspectives.
Yeah, but nothing. It's hard to say, isn't it? If you're going to read up on an issue, how much time do you want to invest reading up on, I mean, it's almost died a death now, but the emerging church. How much time should a pastor give to that? One or two books or one or two articles? A lot depends, doesn't it, on whether that issue is a clear and present danger to your own congregation or the church connection you're part of. So, I think some of the answers different men gave do reflect the situations that they're in. And a lot of these things are judgment calls, aren't they, at the time? How you handle particular matters.
One thing I really interested was some of the questions you asked, one that you asked of Dr. Truman, Carl Truman. Were there any errors or aberrant theologies or heresies that impacted you or that you were tempted with in the past? That just struck me as interesting, and he mentioned that he would, in the late 80s, had been interested in Bardianism and some other things, and I thought that was a really apt question. It really helped expose and show that a lot of these men we highly respect in terms of their conservative approach today have a history of dealing with and being persuaded by other theologies that that we really don't appreciate.
Yeah. That was really helpful. And it's a question that I asked to several of the contributors just to give us a flavor, really, of their own background and what they've wrestled with. And particularly if they perhaps were at seminary with men who later drifted quite considerably theologically and how they coped with all of that. Yeah, as part of the personal dimension, we're not dealing with abstract theological issues, but things that shape the course of people's lives and alter their ministries and harm churches and so on.
Well, you mentioned that the emergent church has been beaten to death. Open theology or open theism is maybe becoming a little bit old. It's still a pressing issue, absolutely still important that we address it, but it's been around for a little while.
Would you say that open theism is maybe becoming mainline or mainstream, and that's part of the reason why we don't see it? It seems old, but in this instance, that's becoming. I remember when it first broke on the scene 15 or 16 years ago within evangelical circles, with the publication of Clark Pinnock's couple of books that I think InterVarsity published. But it's become much more pervasively held in the broader evangelical community. When Christianity Today magazine allowed it to be a legitimate evangelical expression, that kind of gave away the store, so to speak.
Yeah, I think one of the hard things to gauge is when each movement has had its 15 minutes of fame and the publicity dies down. Obviously, the whole thing hasn't disappeared. It's still there, and some people have bought into it and shaped their thinking. And it's not always easy then to gauge just how widespread it is. I mean, how many churches, how many people really are still hooked on this and convinced by it? So things never entirely go away, do they?
Right.
How would you handle other differences in theology? I'm thinking about differences on baptism, differences on administration of the Lord's Supper, for instance. Where do we draw the line in terms of church membership and in terms of ecumenical fellowship? How do we know when something's a big enough deal to really draw the line on membership, and when it's not as big of a deal, and we should remain as one local body?
I think in some situations, I hesitate to want to turn those secondary issues, because sometimes we can it doesn't matter what we think, or the Bible isn't clear, and you almost relegated to a place where you're not going to take it seriously or think it through. On the other hand, you just have to be conscious of the lines people are drawing between their views of the sacraments and the gospel, doctrines of justification and regeneration, and ask what exactly is going on here, because it's quite possible, isn't it, for somebody's view of the sacraments to take on such a misshapen life that you do find the gospel is being revised.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And at that point, then, you could ask, well, is it really responsible to actually treat this as a minor issue that Christians can disagree upon? And of course, churches have different practices. I remember preaching in a church in the south of England a few years back, a particular Baptist church. There was an older Presbyterian couple present, and after I preached, there was no minister at the church at the time, but I think one of the deacons led at the Lord's table, and this older Presbyterian couple, because they'd not been baptized by immersion, were not allowed to partake of the Lord's Supper. And that just seemed to me to be downright wrong. It just seemed to be elevating the doctrine of baptism to a very, very unhelpful place.
Now, I'm thinking recently of some comments that Mark Dever made, I believe in a blog post a little while ago, and he spoke about how if you incorrectly administer baptism, then you are sinning. Or if you have the wrong view, then it is sin. And he really upset some people. But I, and along with Daryl Hart, really thinking, well, that's a consistent view. And we think that if you don't administer baptism to covenant children, then you are sinning as well. So we didn't take as much offense to it. But I was just struck by this idea that people are thinking that error, real error, whether I'm not, you know, whether the paedobaptists or the credobaptists are in error, that one side is actually in sin. Well, it was struck that that really offended people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting here in the UK, or particularly in Wales, lots of our churches with Presbyterian roots, when men seceded from the Presbyterian Church of Wales, a lot of the churches actually became Baptist or became open on the policy of baptism, either making allowance for good conscience paedobaptists, even though the main position of the church would have been baptism of believers by immersion, but also welcoming into membership Christians who were paedobaptists into churches that had now adopted a believers baptism position. And as long as they had thought through the issue and could give good biblical reasons as to why they continued to be paedobaptists, lots of churches didn't make an issue of it. And I can only think at the time that actually reflects that what was really at stake for all those churches and in the whole church scene was actually the gospel itself. To separate from Presbyterian Church of Wales and other groupings that have become so infiltrated with liberal theology that men took the view that they were beyond the pale, well, they weren't going to fight other believers on baptism when they were actually fighting for the gospel, the survival of gospel churches. And I do think if you have the strength of numbers and resources, you can be a bit more pernickety about some of your battles on baptism than maybe you would be actually if what is at stake, are the great fundamental truths of the gospel. And I figure that's what happened in Wales, and that explains. It's not that anybody wanted to be careless in their views of baptism, but the importance was having churches that were gospel churches with at a time when there was a scarcity of gospel ministers. You know, the big issues were really what led the day rather than those other debates.
But Martin, there's recently been a discussion about whether it's proper for an individual to say that N.T. Wright or a Federal Vision proponent has another gospel, or whether that ought to be left to ecclesiastical bodies. What would you say to that question? Is it right for individuals to make a statement about whether a public figure has a true gospel, or whether that should be left to the church? I know that's hard in individual Baptist churches to say that, maybe in a associated denomination.
Yeah, there's some really thorny issues there, aren't there? Between dealing with public figures, B, dealing with people who are sometimes drawn to labels, and then you have to discern, but are they, you know, how much of the theology associated with that label have they really taken on board? One helpful comment in Joel Beakey's interview in the book is where he just makes a helpful comment about not associating in a public way with men whose theologies are not clear on the gospel, because in the end it's going to cause confusion and it's going to cause harm. And that's a question of wisdom, isn't it? You can pronounce on particular individuals, but if you end up endorsing somebody who has not been entirely clear, for starters, maybe has made statements that are more problematic, you do have to be careful. It's the one and the many, isn't it? Who am I really trying to protect? Is it somebody's reputation, or is it the harm that can be caused to a whole church or significant sectors of people? And guys, I just think this is a really difficult but really, really important issue. And, you know, it's kind of, I think, proceed with caution, because we're not always, we're like Corinthians, aren't we? We're not always wise enough about the theological issues. We think about the personalities, and our attachment is to the personality,
right,
rather than to the theology that a person holds or doesn't hold.
And that comes down to Carl Truman has also made some comments lately about how if you ever address somebody's theology, nowadays people are so sensitive, it's taken as a personal attack. And really, there is an appropriate way. We need to address the theology, but there is a correct way to do it in terms of distinguishing it from the person. But we have such a difficult time in our present day and age of doing that. And every time we address error, it's seen as a personal attack.
Yeah, and that just reveals to them that the different levels of maturity. I think nobody wants to advocate shooting from the hip and
no.
being careless in our comments about people, and we want to speak well of people, and yet there are times when we're going to have to say, actually, this person has written this, and it's out in the public realm. This wasn't an off-the-cuff comment he made at a conference, and it doesn't square with where our church stands on these matters. Tough issues. People can be terribly naive about error, and they expect expect false teachers to, you know, have fangs and an obvious pelt, when actually the whole New Testament emphasis on the appearance of false teachers is on their plausibility. error is not going to come from obvious sources. It's actually going to come from folks maybe who have a track record of being helpful and orthodox, and yet they begin to go astray and refuse to be corrected on a particular point.
Mm-hmm.
The harm really comes.
And I've found it a helpful heuristic. I forget where I heard it the first time, but generally speaking, heretics or people with really poor theology personally are never as bad as their theology or never as consistent as their theology. We need to take that into account in our personal dealings with error, but we also need to remember that people are usually never as good as their good theology either. And so as we deal with people, remember, we're dealing with human beings, and we need to, you know, treat this very carefully, that though we get into these very difficult, thorny issues, we always need an attitude of humility and an attitude of love, first and foremost, as we seek to address error. And if we don't address it, really, we're not loving our neighbor either. And so all of this is a helpful approach, and we really appreciate your efforts in bringing this book to us, and all the efforts of the contributors. We think you've done a great service to the church, and thank you for your time today, Martin. We really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you ever so much, and I do hope the book will just stimulate people to think and strengthen them in an area that is crucial. I'm about to start preaching through Galatians at the moment.
Mm.
You know, the lines of truth and error and why they're so serious are all laid out there, and Paul's willingness to... I mean, Peter hasn't gone wrong on the gospel, but he's behaving in a way that is denying the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And his feelings are not spared is because of what's at stake. So they're all crucial issues. So I just hope people will read the book, and it'll stimulate their thinking and strengthen their convictions and their practice.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to let everyone know you can visit Martin online at against-heresies.blogspot.com. We'd encourage you to subscribe to that if you can. It's a very helpful blog. You can also find his chapter in Reforming or Conforming, which we interviewed him on earlier back in our archives, and I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. There's a lot of helpful stuff. Martin's available online. You can get a hold of him. You can also visit us at reformedforum.org. And visit our other websites like feedingonchrist.com and get all sorts of resources, links to various things around the web, and listen to what we're doing. We thank everybody for listening. Hope you'll join us again on Christ the Center.